Thank you for attending session 372 titled How Families Will Find Purpose and Values in Tomorrow's Religious Landscape. On behalf of Sunstone, we want to thank you for attending and encourage you to attend the epic Mormon potluck at the park just east of the venue, a comedy show and kickball game between Mormon fundamentalists and ex-Mormons. Tickets are $10 as a donation to Sunstone and available for purchase at the registration desk. We would love to have you join us. Look to your printed program for instructions to the park. This session is being recorded, and you will be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. Please silence your cell phones and remain respectful. As you leave us tonight, we want to thank you for coming and being part of this Sunstone Symposium. You have participated in a tradition of Mormon history that is over 40 years long. The restoration tradition can be what we make it, and your participation helps make Mormonism a little more diverse, interesting, and inclusive. Please support Sunstone by making a donation, subscribing to the magazine and podcast, and by attending our regional conferences. The next conference will be in London in September. There is nothing like traveling the world with your favorite Sunstone friends. Please join us. Sunstone cannot exist without your financial support. We want to keep this community growing in a healthy, vibrant way to engage Mormonism. Thank you for being a part of that. The session is 90 minutes long, and we ask both audience and presenters to keep within the framework so that folks can get out to dinner on time. This presentation is sponsored by the Mormon Transhumanist Association. As technology accelerates cultural upheaval, Mormon transhumanists champion prophetic visions of human potential. Our presenters, Becca Ogden is a writer and activist involved with Provo Girls Summit, and John Ogden is the author of When Mormons Doubt. They have two kids.
Thanks. We're aiming to make this 50 minutes, so not the full 90 minutes. So, yeah, yep. Thanks so much for coming. I'm John. This is Becca, and we're presenting on as part of the transhumanist series, as you heard. So, I wanted to start with a bit of a thought experiment, and since we're talking about families, to go back in time to see through the eyes of your ancestors. So to start, I wanted to talk about a moment, if you'll think of your parents, a moment of wonder. It might have been maybe they saw the man on the moon. I don't know if your parents have told you anything, seeing that. Maybe it was some other technological advancement. Maybe grandparents, the first time they ever flew, the first time they experienced electricity, if you're going back far enough, the rise of vaccines, great-grandparents, just going back in time, the first time that they experienced plumbing instead of having to go to an outhouse. If you keep going back farther in time, 150 to 200 years ago, maybe the first symphony that your ancestor experienced, the first time that they went to a museum and saw art from around the world. And if you keep going back, maybe 1,000 years ago, thousands of years ago, even, the first civilization. You can imagine the first ancestor who entered a civilization, what that was like. Or the first ancestor that held a coin in their hands. 10,000 years ago or more, perhaps the first to start a farm, the first to stay in one place their whole life to irrigate the crops, maybe the first to domesticate sheep, goats, pigs, cows, before that, wolves. How about 50 to 100,000 years ago, the first to hold a statue of a fertility goddess in their hands? Your first ancestor to say a prayer, or your first ancestor to perform a ritual, the first to use blades and bones for tools, the first to bury their dead, the first to believe in gods. How about 200,000 years ago, the dawn of Homo sapiens, right? What was it like to be that ancestor, just to be slightly distinct from other human ancestors? Have a slightly larger brain. And we keep going. A million years ago and more, the first ancestor to cook with fire. What was that like to discover that? The first, perhaps, to look at the stars and wonder what secrets they keep. The first to use a stone tool to cut or to kill. 5 million years ago, your first ancestor to regularly walk on two legs, allowing them to travel enormous distances. And you can feel what it's like to travel so far that they never see the place that they were born again. What was that like for the first time? And we can keep going. 20 million years ago, the first great ape who's slightly distinct, slightly more human than the other animals. 65 million years ago, the first primate, the first mammal with forward-facing eyes. 150 million years ago, your first ancestor that was a mammalian reptile with hints of fur, sweat glands, and jaw joints, darting around forest floors, searching for insects and other food. 500 million years ago, your first amphibian ancestor, the first to live a majority of your life on land. And beyond that, your first ancestor that was a fish with bony appendages squirming in the sea. Back a billion years or more, be your first ancestor with lungs, your first ancestor with a jaw, the first with a backbone. And a billion years before that, be the eyeless, few-celled organisms darting around in water. And on to 3 or 4 billion years or more, be the first single-cell life form. And back, and for billions of years, be water and be rock and be heat. So this is a big picture worldview reduced to a 24-hour clock. So if time started at just a minute after midnight, that would be the formation of the Earth. You can see the origin of life started at 4 a.m. And then for that time, it took from 4 a.m. to 2 p.m. to become a single-cell algae. Sexual reproduction started at 6 p.m. 8:30 p.m., seaweed, jellyfish, land plants. Dinosaurs at 10:56 p.m., mammals at 11:40, and humans have been around for a minute and 17 seconds. The reason I'm a transhumanist is because I see it inevitable that if we survive, we're going to evolve more beyond this. Right? Who's to say what happens if we live for another minute here? How about another 10 minutes? What, another hour on this scale? If we've only been around for a minute and 17 seconds, that means that just a few seconds ago, we developed modern technology. And maybe 10 seconds ago? I don't know. Jesus. So much has happened so quickly, and if we just live a little bit longer, we're going to continue to evolve. So I see transhumanism as an inevitability, so long as we don't screw it all up. Not only that, but now for the first time, we can see these patterns as humanity, and we have the ability to dramatically change evolution. This is an image from Elon Musk's company Neuralink, where it embeds computer technology into the brain through threads. And if we're already on this cusp, we can only say what happens in 100 years, 1,000 years, 10,000 years. So we can now engineer the human race. This places a big responsibility on us. In Mormon terms, Joseph Smith said, you have got to learn how to be gods yourselves, to be kings and priests to God, and the same as all gods have done before you. This places a big responsibility on us today, but a big opportunity. And so we must ask, what sort of gods do we want to be? So they're the gods of the Old Testament, right, or the God of the Old Testament, flooding the earth, killing all humans, except for Noah and his family, tearing down the walls of Jericho, killing a bunch of people in the process. There's Saturn eating his children in Roman mythology. In New Testament mythology, the four horsemen of the apocalypse, bringing terror and destruction upon the planet. And we have, so far, in many ways, worshipped the most destructive qualities of the gods. Humans, Homo sapiens, started in this area in Africa around 200,000 years ago. And wherever we've gone, we've tended to, the geological record shows that we've kind of laid destruction wherever we've gone. And as human population increases, so does the extinction crisis. So we're faced with some big problems. You can see we're laying waste to ecology and hurting other species. In a sense, we are already being gods. And yet, well, I'll say one more thing. So this is Utah Lake, nearby where I live, and my pioneer ancestors put in invasive species, carp, and flooded it with sewage, which has caused problems and is still causing problems today. It's often infested with toxic algae that leads to destruction and disease. So these are big problems that we're facing, and we have the opportunity to work to solve some of these problems and evolve the future of humanity in a positive way. One purpose of our life then might be to be the ancestors of better gods than we've been given. And this gets us to what we can do as families to take part in this grand mission.
So how do we find our purpose and how do we define our values? One way that we can do this is to use our moral imagination. I like this phrase, moral imagination. It comes from, it's a common combination of words, but the poet and writer Percy Bysshe Shelley talked about it famously in his essay on poetry. It says, a man, to be greatly good, must imagine intensely and comprehensively. He must put himself in the place of another and many others. The pains and pleasures of his species must become his own. The great instrument of moral good is the imagination. And so our capacity to imagine is perhaps one of our greatest moral tools. I really like thinking about the human brain when it imagines. And I know that this is probably common knowledge, but when they ask someone to imagine something or even read a passage from a book and it describes an action, they've actually taken MRI scans of these people's brains and seen that the same parts of the brain that are used for the actual action light up when you're just imagining it. So if you're imagining lifting weights, they've actually measured that you can increase muscle mass. So maybe you guys should all do that while I'm giving my presentation and get a good workout. If you're imagining skiing, the same parts of your brain lights up as though you were actually skiing. And so this is incredible, right? We can imagine, you know, sitting a palace in some foreign country, being in charge of a nation. We can imagine being in a place in our own country that's impoverished. And we can imagine being a child. We can imagine being someone elderly. We can imagine being someone ill. We can imagine suffering. And so I think this is incredible. An incredible moral tool is the imagination. What helps us to imagine? It's stories. When we tell stories to each other, when we tell ourselves stories, these are instructive, and they require us to use our moral imagination, right? I like to think of this in terms of past, present, future, stories of where we came from, stories of why we're here, and stories of where we're going. It's a lot like A Christmas Carol, right? Where you have the ghosts of Christmas past and present and future. Stories of where we came from. Actually, there's been a lot of research done on how this impacts our own personal stories. So actually, some researchers at Emory University did a study where they asked a bunch of participants, what do you know? And they asked them questions about their families. They asked them, like, Do you know where your parents met? Do you know what country your family's from? Do you know the story of your birth? And they found something incredible. The people who knew these stories, they studied them over a period of time. The people who knew the stories about where they came from actually were more resilient as human beings. As they went through suffering, as they went through different challenges, they could actually form this narrative in their mind. Oh, my ancestors went through such and such thing. My personal history, you know, I was born a C-section, so I can overcome adversity, that type of thing. If you have a strong personal narrative and a strong sense of a narrative of where you come from, then actually influences how resilient you are as a person. So for me personally, I think of stories of where I came from as being a really strong component of my own moral imagination. I imagine, so actually my grandmother grew up in Germany during World War II, and she was a teenager during that time. And it was a very cruel landscape. She was kicked out of her house, had to survive on odd jobs throughout Germany as a maid. And this is a part of my own narrative that I've adopted because I see, oh, this is where I came from. This is part of my genetic legacy almost. And I certainly think that same way about my pioneer ancestors. You know, all the things that they did, maybe the legacy of them bringing carp into Utah Lake was not the best legacy, but a lot of their suffering and trials and all those sorts of things influence who I am, the story of who I am as a person. Same with my European ancestors. And on and on and on, and goes far, far back. Next, stories of why we're here. So why are we here? In terms of evolution, we could say that we're here to experience the present moment completely. And something that we like to do in our house is watch Mr. Rogers. And we both really love the phrase that Mr. Rogers says, "It's such a good feeling to know you're alive." That's why we're here, right? We're here to experience the present fully. But not just that, we're here to alleviate the suffering of others around us. So one thing that's incredible about this current time and place, right, is that we have access to stories of people's suffering, of people's joy. It's like democratized the storytelling process across the world. I can sit down at my computer and pull up a story of someone who I've never met before and know intimately what they're going through. I really, really like this quote by Neil Gaiman, who's one of my favorite storytellers. It's from his book, one of his books in the Sandman series. He says, "Everybody has a secret world inside of them. I mean everybody, all the people in the whole world. No matter how dull and boring they are on the outside, inside them they've all got unimaginable, magnificent, wonderful, stupid, amazing worlds. Not just one world, hundreds of them, thousands maybe." So I think of the first time that I read life-changing stories that really opened up my brain to the way that the world is and can be. There are so many, transportive stories. And so I'll go on. Stories of where we're going. So this aspect is one that maybe I'm the most excited about, is probably because my dad introduced me to stories of a utopian future society. So my dad, when he was little, watched the moon landing. You know, he watched it on a TV screen that was like this big, and it just lit up his entire world, and he became really excited about science fiction. So when Star Trek came out, he was a big Trekkie, and when I was little, I used to watch Star Trek with him. And I would say that's probably the inspiration behind my transhumanism, is envisioning a future where technology and humans work together to create a utopia, where people live together. And one thing that I really love about stories of the future that are utopic in this way are the way that they imagine humans can evolve their souls. We've talked a lot about how technology has evolved, about how human creations have evolved, but have humans really evolved their souls? And I love this vision of the future that's in Star Trek and lots of other science fiction stories and fiction stories that imagine the future as humans whose souls have also evolved. Gene Roddenberry, the creator of Star Trek, often he would put his writers in a bind. He would say, the humans that are on the Starship Enterprise. They're not allowed to fight with each other. They don't have internal conflicts. The characters have to get along. And the writers would be like, what do we write about? But it turns out there's a lot, because they're exploring the galaxy and whatnot. But what they found was that envisioning that future of humans who actually are getting along and have evolved souls was really inspiring. So, past, present, future stories can keep us anchored to the past, grounded in the present, and looking towards the future. But right now, a lot of our stories don't point us in this direction. A lot of our stories are about consumerism, and that mostly comes from just the fact that a lot of people have figured out the best ways to get us to spend money. So I look at this picture of Target, and the thing that strikes me about this image is how there's like not a single living thing in this picture. There's not a tree, there's not a plant, there's not an animal. I think there might be a blurred human over there in the background.
There's a tree branch at
the top. Oh, look, there's a tree. Good. Selective editing, right? But by and large, it's a pretty depressing scene. It's not something that you would have framed in the Louvre or something like that. There's not a lot of integration between living things. It's solely a place that was decided, this is how this is going to look, because it's the minimum amount of beauty that we can put into a place, and people will still go there and not be too depressed to buy things. And so we have this as one of our main narratives. And I think of the way that, so I drive on State Street in Orem almost every day. And it's that same sort of bleak consumer landscape where not a lot of thought is put into the human experience of me driving that road every single day. It's like very dehumanizing to drive on State Street in Orem. But not only has it sort of erased beauty and integration with nature from our narratives, it's also sort of desensitized us to human suffering, because it doesn't make financial sense to alleviate every single kind of human suffering. I really love, going back to the Christmas Carol, I really love when Scrooge is visited by Jacob Marley, and they're talking, and Scrooge is astounded that Marley is covered in all these chains. I'm sure that you're all familiar with this story, but he's amazed that he's dragging around all these boxes. And Scrooge says, "But you were always a good man of business, Jacob," faltered Scrooge, who now began to apply this to himself. "Business," cried the ghost, wringing its hands again. "Mankind was my business. Charity, mercy, forbearance, and benevolence were all my business. The deals of my trade were but a drop of water in the comprehensive ocean of my business." So right now, our consumer society erases suffering from the narrative of profit, of consumption. And so storytelling and imagination, that moral imagination, is the answer to this. I look at this and I think, wouldn't it be better if instead of imagining a place where you have the minimum amount of beauty to buy something, you actually have a city of flowers, a city of integrated life where people are with living things and surrounded by beauty constantly, where we're imagining places where people live that actually elevate our souls and evolve our souls and ask us to be better human beings, because we're treating ourselves with compassion and surrounding ourselves with life and beauty and connectedness. So, but this is all kind of heady stuff, right? It's like vague, yes, we should be connected to everything. Yes, we should imagine a good moral future. But something that we like to do in our family is actually break it down. What are these things that we're imagining for ourselves, for our family? What are we actually putting into the world in terms of concrete guidance? So we have this list. Oh, here, I should probably go through those. Physical health, intellectual health, spiritual health, and social health. So as a family, we've sat down and we've picked out some guidelines that we all sort of agree on of what we're doing to evolve, to be the ancestors of future gods, right? What kinds of descendants are we creating? What kind of ways are we evolving the human soul? So if we start out with physical health, it's pretty simple. we say that we, so we go through this and we talk about this in a family home evening. We'll go through and like be like, okay, what are our values for physical health? So we have nutrition, where we eat real, nutrient-rich food and consume mindfully. Exercise, commit to regular endurance, strength, and flexibility training, nothing too hard. And sleep, end the day deliberately, not mindlessly looking at a screen, and get enough sleep. So just simply like saying this out loud to our kids, we've noticed makes a big difference. And when we are doing something that doesn't jive with what's on the list, our kids or one of us will be like, hey, we agreed as a family that these are our values. Oops, did I skip? No, I did not skip. So we have spiritual health, wisdom, reflect daily on sacred texts from the world's wisdom traditions. So being part of a transhumanist future means owning all of human history and just being willing to take it apart and look at it and piece together a grand narrative, right? If we think back to that thought experiment that we did in the beginning, we have so much ownership of all of these ancestral stories, and they really are really rich for a lot of wisdom. Stillness. Find time each day to be still. Live in simple, clean surroundings. And nature. Commune with nature, both in the sense of trees and flowers and also in the sense of the divine. So we also have intellectual health, which this one we have talked a lot about, and we feel like we do a pretty good job of modeling it for our kids, mostly by reading a lot, but we thought we would get even more specific and talk about humility. Admit you've been wrong and will be wrong again. There's nothing more essential to developing good intellectual health than to just admit that you're wrong. Curiosity, stay hungry for learning, question your assumptions, especially your most tightly held assumptions, and grit. Develop the intellectual rigor of an academic. Reject pseudoscience, particularly in medical, spiritual, and religious circles. Read difficult texts. Read the classics. Watch Star Trek, right? So, and then we have social health, which encompasses family, friendship, and compassion. So family, care about the evolving needs of each family member. I really like thinking about families in terms of a bunch of circles, and each member of the family are different circles. And in a family that's sort of out of balance, where they're sacrificing too much for one person, that circle grows too large, and the whole family gets out of balance. So we recognize that we're part of a cohesive unit that has to sacrifice and sort of bend to each other's needs. Friendship, invest in friendship and sacrifice for friends. Enjoy your time with them and be fully present when you're with them. And compassion, feel the pain of those who suffer most, including ancestors and descendants. And use your heart and head to know what you can do to alleviate that pain. So that's part of that storytelling, right? Compassion. So before I kind of jump back to John, I want to talk about one of my favorite stories. I really, when we were thinking about what to talk about in this panel, I was like, we just have to talk about stories, because stories is the way to a transhumanist future. And John was like, okay. So I recently read a book that is by a woman named Ursula K. Le Guin, and she writes tons and tons of books, or has written tons and tons of books. And there's a book that she wrote called The Dispossessed. Has anyone read this book, The Dispossessed? Cool, I won't spoil it for you, but I will set it up. So in The Dispossessed, it's about an Earth-like civilization that is very similar to our own. So they actually are a capitalist society, consumerist, actually very materialistic. And then there's another society where this is not the case, and they actually populate the moon. And the main character of this book is from this other society, and so he comes and looks at this society with an outsider's perspective. And at one point in the novel, he is at a very, very fancy party, surrounded by very materialistic people with insane clothing and jewels, and they have this crazy thing where they implant magnets into their bodies and put jewels all over their bodies through magnets. And so they're dressed elaborately, immaculate makeup, very, very wealthy, very, very plush and luxurious surroundings. And someone asks this main character to describe his place of residence, his community. And he's like very reluctant at first, but they press him and press him, and finally he says this. So the place is called Anaris. There you go, sci-fi word for the day. It is an ugly world, not like this one. Anaris is all dusty and dry hills, all meager, all dry. And the people aren't beautiful. They have big hands and feet, like me, but not big bellies. They get very dirty and take baths together. Nobody here does that. The towns are very small and dull. They're dreary. No palaces. Life is dull and hard work. You can't always have what you want or even what you need because there isn't enough. You have enough. Enough air, enough rain, grass, oceans, food, music, buildings, factories, machines, books, clothes, history. You are rich. You own. We are poor. We lack. You have. We do not have. Everything is beautiful here, only not the faces. On Anaris, nothing is beautiful, nothing but the faces. The other faces, the men and women, we have nothing but that, nothing but each other. Here you see the jewels, there you see the eyes. And in the eyes you see the splendor of the human spirit. Because our men and women are free. Possessing nothing, they are free. And you, the possessors, are possessed. You are all in jail, each alone, solitary, with a heap of what he owns. You live in prison, die in prison. It is all I can see in your eyes. And then later in the book, he says, you cannot make the revolution. You can only be the revolution. It is in your spirit, or it is nowhere. So I think of these things, especially in terms of the moral imagination and what we're imagining for ourselves. And when I think of the moral imagination, I think of this. I think of a place where we're telling ourselves stories that are more than ownership and possession. They encompass all of these things that we've been talking about: physical health, intellectual health, spiritual health, and social health. Anyway, John's going to talk a little bit more about envisioning that future.
Yeah, and I'll just wrap up. Honestly, the idea here is that we have the potential to create something, and we have to create something. The main impetus for me is that I see Mormonism as it is currently practiced as unsustainable. That if my kids don't fall from it, their kids will, or their kids' kids will. Either Mormonism will evolve or will go by the wayside. What will it mean in 200 years or in 400 years or in 1,000 years as people look back on it? We have the opportunity to create something anew. And so, just in conclusion, this idea is something that we're wrestling with, Becca and I and our kids, and we're doing it in community. We live in Provo, and just the in terms of specifics, I'm a big part of Lower Lights, which is a group that's involved in mindfulness and meditation. There's Awakening Valley Sangha in Provo, and then the Mormon Transhumanist Group that I'm involved with. And so there's, in the near term at the local level, the urgency is to develop a place for families to live on purpose and develop values. For us, that's Provo, Utah, but it's for all of humanity is trying to figure out what values are we going to hold in community to create stronger bonds and to look at the future of tomorrow. And then in the long term and at the global level, we desperately need to develop an ecologically sustainable post-scarcity economy, a community full of healthy, thriving human beings who live according to their individual strengths, or a city of flowers. I'll just say in closing that this is more of a vision and a sensing. I really am optimistic for the future. If we can keep evolving without causing ecological destruction, the future of humanity is going to be far better than the present, far better than anything we've ever seen. And we have an opportunity as a community to again, be the ancestors of better gods than we've been given. And that's it. Thank you. Long time. We could just do three questions or something like that. Just a few. And then you can go elsewhere.
So I'll do a brief comment.
Okay.
With respect to the slide, one of you, I think it was you, presented that was talking about the stories about us and stories about our future. There's a Neil Gaiman quote that I'm quite fond of. He said, fairy tales are true, not because they teach us that there are dragons, but because they teach us that those dragons can be defeated.
Yes, mm-hmm. I love it.
Yeah.
And I actually debated whether I should put that on the screen. But I love it so much. And I think it's really illustrative of, like, not only are we instructed by actual real-life stories of people experiencing things around us, but I find that some of the most compelling stories are ones that are outside of anyone's real lived experience. In some ways more true.
Yeah. Yeah, we can somehow grasp metaphors better than we can grasp reality.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. If that is it. Oh, you have a question? Yeah. You can send it for two back. Yeah, please.
Okay, I'm going to get a little personal just because I need more focused ideas. I love this. This was great. This was so great. This is exactly what we're working on with our family. But how old are your kids?
We have an 8-year-old and a 4-year-old.
Okay. So what does this look like on a daily basis for you?
Well, Leo, do you want to chime in? No,
So this is really the structure that is grounded in daily activity.
Yeah.
So it's you know, what can we do daily to practice nutrition, exercise, sleep? Wisdom is read daily from the wisdom traditions.
So, like, do you do that, like, at night, like, everyone gathering together?
We have, like, Buddhist stories or...
we have a bunch of collections of, like, world stories that we read together as family. And
I still really enjoy the Bible and at times the Book of Mormon as wisdom texts. So it's wisdom wherever it's found.
Yeah.
As a ritual and as a daily practice. Stillness, getting into meditation and nature, trying deliberately to spend more time being in nature. The same with this, like, how do we value academic virtue? And then with social health, it would be really valuing friendship, but then also carving out time for compassion. That's one that... All of these are ideals that we fall short of, myself especially, but by having them stated and written down, they become more real because we see that we have to live up to these ideals.
So they're like in your home somewhere?
Well, since they're so newly drafted, like in the past 6 months, they're still in flux a bit. So in family moving, we'll be like, well, what do you think? You know, to our kids, we'll ask it to each other, you know, is this real? And so it's kind of still in test mode.
Mm-hmm. This is a prototype.
Yeah, the prototype. Yeah.
That's what we're doing, too.
It's good to do, like, feel that it has roots, then yes.
Then you'll put it out.
We'll probably put it out.
Okay. Yeah. And another personal question. So I've noticed that gathering my family for meditation is just as hard as family prayer, and no one wants to do that. Is that just my family, or is that...
No.
Do you feel like it's still working even if they are in a bad mood?
I really value my own like mindfulness training when it comes to like trying to experience it with my kids. I really like something that I was practicing mindfulness with someone who had a lot more experience than me, and she said her mentor told her there's no such thing as a bad sit. And I'm like, that's a common expression in meditation. And I agree that's true of children as well. If they're sitting there, even if they're not paying attention, there's no such thing as bad sit. I think that it will be a lot rockier and weirder, and maybe they won't like it, but shorten it. spice it up. I don't know.
And there are good apps for kids on meditation.
Yeah. Like we use Insight Timer and kids. Calm. Yeah, and they're shorter, and that's helpful. But yeah, it's also hard because I found this true of reading as well. If you like push them to read something, they'll like become resentful and they're like, no, I don't want to do it. So I think it has to be balanced out with like, yeah, sometimes we're not going to do it because we're all not into it. That's okay. Just let it go. It's fine. I think that like as Mormons, we're kind of like, we have that discipline, like that spiritual discipline of like, just sitting down, putting your butts in the chair, and like, we're going to do family meeting, we're going to do family prayer, we're going to do scripture study. I think that there's wisdom in that, but there's also wisdom in just sort of like, maybe not today.
intuiting.
I have a comment about that too, if that's okay.
Yeah,
so from what I have, some of the things I pulled away from your presentation is kind of trying to find this balance between structure and flexibility. And within a Mormon framework, we have a lot of structure provided for families, especially, family home evening and whatever else, scripture study and prayer. And we can utilize some of that structure to introduce some of these ideas or, mindfulness with our family as part of our family home evening tradition, but also some flexibility in what kind of stories we're telling ourselves and we're telling our families of like what it means to be a Mormon and how rigidly they have to hold to that structure, because I agree with you, I don't feel like it's super, what was your word? Sustainable, the way it's currently practiced. I watch, so many friends and family members who just, they hold on for as long as they can and then they leave because it's either too painful or it's just not working for them. But I think that, sharing those stories of our ancestors can be really grounding for a lot of people, but we have to be more flexible in how we're doing it so that there's room for growth and change and evolution. So I appreciate your presentation.
Thank you so much.
Does anyone else have any comments they want to share?
Go ahead.
So you talked about Star Trek.
Yeah.
And you talked about fairy tales. So what about like myth? Are you just encompassing all myth, the hero's journey, Joseph Campbell stuff? Are you finding, is it pioneer stories? Bringing it all in.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Is there a question behind that question?
No.
Because it sounds like.
No. I'm just curious. How far-reaching and where your focuses are on all of that. I had to get the jab in about Star Wars versus Star Trek because, right?
Absolutely. And I think that all kinds of myth are really important in terms of being morally instructive. I think that's one of the most valuable things about myth, and especially. With myths that aren't sustainable, which we've observed in Mormonism, some myths going by the wayside because they couldn't be carried on anymore. Some spiritual myths that we no longer subscribe to, like currently practicing polygamy, that type of thing. Myths that like have been let go. And so in terms of like trying to figure out a new myth that sort of brings that moral cohesion and social cohesion, this idea of evolution as a species, of our purpose is to evolve. And that, I think, being sort of the grand myth that we're looking towards in this setting when we're talking to our families of, like, why do we make this list? Why do we talk about physical, intellectual, social, and spiritual health? It's because we're part of this grand narrative, this mythological narrative of, like, we're humans, we're going to evolve. And that's, hopefully, ideally, that's really inspiring. In addition to all the fictional myths or actual myths that are useful to us at the time or morally instructive at the time. But.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and what I found is that, so initially I wanted to do a canon, and I still do, of like wisdom traditions around the world, gather them all together for adults and for kids. But what I found lately is that after going through compendiums of these, that I still have a preference for the myths of my tradition, specifically like Bible, the stories of Jesus, I still privilege those over. They're not just another myth for me, and I think that they are. They shouldn't be because our society is built more like the society that I happen to have been dealt the cards with. I happen to have been dealt these cards, and so to understand Shakespeare, to understand modern storytelling, even Star Trek is pulling from biblical stories. So there's part of me that says, well, I still do privilege these myths, and I don't feel as bad as I once did for privileging these myths at the same time that I'm trying to expand to all myths. Mm-hmm.
All right. We'd like to thank John Ogden and Becca Ogden and the Mormon Transhumanist Association for sponsoring this presentation. Mormon teachings about humans becoming gods connect with transhumanist ideas about using technology to enhance the humanity. Please visit their booth across the hall to meet with a representative, join, or learn more.
Thank you. Thanks, Sue.